May it please the court. Ethics rules do not altogether prohibit business transactions between lawyers and clients. They do, however, establish mandatory safeguards directed at protecting the client when such transactions do take place. A business transaction between an attorney and his client must be objectively fair to the client. The client must be given a written explanation of the terms of the transaction. The client must have an opportunity to consult with independent counsel, and the client must consent to the arrangement in writing. And that is all according to the 2006 version of the rules. The undisputed facts in this case are enumerated in my brief, and I'll go over them briefly. Mr. Plunkett was Mr. Shoemaker's client at the time that Mr. Shoemaker engaged in a business transaction with him in September of 2006. He was his client because Mr. Shoemaker had been representing him in a personal injury case since 2004. The case was ongoing and being actively prosecuted by Mr. Shoemaker, and the things that were being done in the case are enumerated in my brief. In September of 2006, Mr. Shoemaker prepared and Mr. Plunkett signed a promissory note from Mr. Shoemaker from Mr. Plunkett to the Shoemakers, in which Mr. Plunkett promised to pay the Shoemakers $250,000, and he also signed a deed of trust in a house on some property that he owned in Boone County, Missouri, to the Shoemakers. Mr. Shoemaker recorded subsequently that deed of trust. Mr. Shoemaker provided Mr. Plunkett with no conflicts waiver before entering into that transaction with him. Mr. Shoemaker did not prepare or provide Mr. Plunkett with a written explanation of the transaction, which was, according to Mr. Shoemaker, additional capital was put into an LLC that Mr. Shoemaker and Mr. Plunkett were both members in exchange for Mr. Plunkett's promise to pay the Shoemakers $250,000 in $35,000 annual increments.
Your opponent argues that the actual loan and deed of trust documents would be sufficient to be the written explanation. And you cited a case that you think we should rely on from
Wisconsin.
Wisconsin. Can you address that?
Yes. The Wisconsin case was, I believe, a loan from a client to a lawyer, and the lawyer argued that the fact that the client signed the loan paperwork would satisfy the requirement of Rule 4-1.8A, that there be a written explanation of the transaction and that the client consent to the conflict in the transaction. So in effect, if that is the law, which the Wisconsin Supreme Court found that it was not, then there would be no reason for that subsection of 1.8 to exist, because if there was any kind of document in the business transaction signed by the client, then that would constitute the signing of a waiver and a written explanation of the transaction. The Wisconsin Supreme Court said clearly that in order to give effect to the rule and its three subsections, there must be a separate writing explaining the transaction, and there must be a separate conflicts waiver signed by the client.
And is that applied to the version of the rule in 2006 or the current version?
It does. The 2006 version of the rule has the word written in it twice. One aspect of it is that the explanation of the transaction must be in writing, and the second time it uses the word written is when it refers to the conflict waiver, which must be signed by the client. So there was no conflicts waiver in the Plunkett-Shoemaker transaction, nor was there a written explanation of what to my mind, is a fairly complicated business transaction given Mr. Shoemaker's explanation of the transaction. It's a little simpler from Mr. Plunkett's version of what happened, in that Mr. Plunkett testified that he had no idea that MACB and additional capital contributions had anything to do with the fact that he was asked on September 12, when he appeared at Mr. Shoemaker's office to ask him to borrow money, and was told, no, you need to sign this paperwork first or you're not getting the check. He, in his mind, thought that he was being required to sign the paperwork to get the $2,000 check to meet his immediate financial needs. And that sounds outrageous, but it isn't, wouldn't it have been, if Mr. Shoemaker had complied with the rule, there would have been a written explanation of the transaction in which he described, you are signing these documents because the Shoemakers are going to borrow money and put money into MACB, which is going to collapse if we don't, and you feel bad about it because you didn't have any money to put into it up front, and so you're going to pay us over 10 years, $35,000 a year, and we're going to take a deed of trust against your house, because then if you don't make these payments to us, we'll have an interest in your house.
In fact, the requirement in the rule for the writings would have the benefit of avoiding the he said, he said.
Absolutely.
As to what the transaction was intended to be or explained to be.
Absolutely. As would had Mr. Shoemaker's secretary followed the rules on notary publics, and if in fact Mr. Plunkett had stood before her and signed the deed of trust on September 14, which is what Mr. Shoemaker's version of the case is, then I would have had no argument that what happened on the 12th happened. But that turned out not to be the case. Even though it said Mr. Plunkett before me stood and signed this document, she admitted that that was not the case. Mr. Plunkett did not stand before her and sign the deed on September 14. Now, the undisputed facts in the third count of the information, and again, these are set forth in the informant's brief, were that the Skintas, a couple that live in Kirksville, owned three lots on a busy intersection in Kirksville in October of 2006. Two of the lots were mortgaged. Those two lots had a pole barn building and a little one-bedroom house on them. They borrowed money in 2004 to purchase those two lots and were current with their mortgage payments until April of 2006, when they stopped paying. So the bank accelerated the loan and had it scheduled to be sold in foreclosure, those two lots, on October 27, 2006 at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. The evidence is undisputed that Mr. Skinta, who suffers from bipolar disorder and was not taking medication that controlled it at that point, contacted Mr. Shoemaker by telephone on October 24. Yeah, that's at the last minute, but that whether Mr. Skinta's wisdom in all of this is not at issue in this case. The fact of the matter is, he did contact Mr. Shoemaker.
Did Mr. Shoemaker dispute that the Skintas were his client at some point in this process?
He does not. I don't really think that he disputes that an attorney-client relationship formed on October 24. I think his argument is that it terminated by the time of the events of October 27, and
there was evidence from the banker, is that correct, that the conversation he had with Mr. Shoemaker did not indicate that he was calling on behalf, even at that point, which I think was before it's claimed the relationship ended. Mr. Shoemaker was calling and asking questions in a manner that indicated not in a representative capacity.
That is what Mr. Major testified in his deposition, that when he was asked questions about it, he said he showed some, expressed some surprise. Oh, I didn't know he was representing the shoemakers when he made that call.
And he supposedly was calling them to ask if the bank would continue the foreclosure on their behalf.
And that's undisputed. Mr. Shoemaker agrees that he did call Mr. Major for the purpose of determining whether the bank would give the Skintas a little more time to try to come up with the money.
But he didn't tell them that it was the Skintas.
He did not say, apparently, according to Mr. Major, he did not say, I'm representing the Skintas.
He just asked if it could get continued.
Correct. All right, there's no dispute that Mr. Shoemaker then communicated to Mr. Skinta that, in fact, the bank would not postpone the hearing. Then we get into disputed evidence. But what is not disputed is that on October 27, 2006, the day of the foreclosure, the Skintas got a call from Mr. Shoemaker's office asking them to come in and sign some paperwork. They assumed, having not, and this is disputed, but that they were going to go sign some magic paperwork that was going to postpone the foreclosure or was going to somehow save them from this mess, because they hadn't heard anything different from Mr. Shoemaker. And I'm just trying to give you here what the undisputed evidence is. So they show up at his office 2 hours before the foreclosure sale on October 27th, 2006, and the paperwork on Ms. Malloy's desk was a warranty deed conveying the house and store lots to an entity called Miller Properties, LLC, and a lease leasing the two lots, the store and house lot, back to the Skintas for $700 a month, which was interesting since their mortgage payment, which they had not been able to make, and why their property was being foreclosed, was $501 per month. So it was $200 more even than the payment they had not been able to make.
Are there any questions?
Thank you. I have to beg your forgiveness because my father, who signed this brief, my 76-year-old mother has had some adverse health consequences, and so I'm the backup quarterback for this argument. I spent my entire Sunday morning with my mother in the emergency room, and so now my father's with her. I think Ms. Whedon's capitalized this case in a nutshell in her closing argument to the hearing panel. She says, how are these rules violated? Let's start with 4.18, and these are complicated rules, at least for me. Now, she spends her entire career dealing with these rules, and she says they're complicated rules. And I think the significance of that is these rules have changed. There's more clarity in the rules today than there was in 2006 when Mr. Shoemaker was confronted with this situation. Specifically, if you look at 4.18, and in 2006, the rule says the client consents in writing thereto. What's the client to consent to in writing? The agreement?
If in fact it is only the agreement, your opponent argues that totally guts the provision, that it just would say transactions have to be in writing. And that makes some sense, that it takes away the explanation of the conflict or the explanation of the it's an unusual transaction for an attorney with a fiduciary relationship to enter into a business arrangement with a client.
Well, quite frankly, with Mr. Plunkett, the relationship that he had with the client was involving a personal injury suit. The transaction involved an entirely different matter. And
that's where the conflict of interest came.
I understand. But I'll suggest to the court that the rule clears it up today. It expressly deals with that today.
Isn't it clear? Because if you're dealing with former clients, it says that it's the same business transaction. It doesn't have that limitation when it's dealing with current clients.
Well, I mean, quite frankly, it says the client gives informed consent in writing, and then it tells you, to the essential terms of the transaction. Today, you have to give written consent to the essential terms of the transaction. So why wasn't that the element or the necessary consent back in 2006? If her argument is right, why did we add that? If it's painfully obvious that he should have given written or gotten written consent of the conflict, then why do we say today, in 2011, that one of the elements that you have to have in writing is to the essential terms of the transaction?
Aren't there other requirements that you have to have in writing?
It goes on to say, and the lawyer's role in the transaction. I think that, and I think that the hearing panel would contend that Mr. Plunkett was a sophisticated person and that he understood what he was getting into. He knew what he was doing. And then it goes on to say, including whether the lawyer is representing the client in the transaction. That was pretty clear, too, that Mr. Shoemaker was not representing in this transaction Mr. Plunkett. So I understand what you're asking me, I believe, except the only part that I don't agree with, I think, is that you're suggesting that it's obvious what the consent should have been back in 2006. And her argument, she's arguing from a Wisconsin case, which I don't know how.
She's arguing based on the rule, and she's pointing to another state that interpreted a similar rule in the way she's arguing. Our rule clearly states.
Okay.
And if I think I understand your argument, you're saying the rule now is more specific as to what is required. And the rule now would not require what she's arguing should have been required back in 2006.
What I'm saying is how you could get confused also is because it's clear that one of the elements today is that there has to be a writing of the essential terms of the transaction, which is what happened. There was a writing of that. There was a writing of the essential terms of the transaction in 2006, and the hearing panel found that he knew about it. He understood it. So I'll suggest to the court that they are complicated rules, and it's important to understand that there could have been more clarity in the rule directing Mr. Shoemaker what he needed to do. Now, I think there's several important points that the hearing panel addressed. One of them is that the panel found Mr. Plunkett was not credible, substantially not credible. Mr. Skinta was substantially not credible. And Mrs. Skinta was substantially not credible. There's a substantial body of evidence and this transcript that would give clear indication that these were not people to be believed. And the hearing panel found that. They enumerated some of those reasons. But if you went through the transcript, there's several examples of that in the transcript. For example, Mr. Plunkett sold these leases. He admits today they were essentially a Ponzi scheme. He sold leases to these people. He got a $60,000 commission from that. And he's never offered to return that to the victim.
The hearing panel, even though it found that they were not credible, still found that your client violated the rules.
The hearing panel found that my client violated the rules, but I'll be happy to discuss those one at a time. The hearing panel found that respondent did not obtain Mr. Plunkett's written consent to the conflict. That goes back to what was it that he was supposed to obtain a written consent to? What was he supposed to enumerate the terms of the agreement, which the panel found he did do? It goes to how clear is the rule in 2006? And should Mr. Shoemaker be required to anticipate the rule changes, which were obviously made to clarify that problem?
Can you read me the portion of the rule in 2006, please, that you're saying is unclear?
Yeah, sure.
In the context.
Okay, now you have to also understand, Mr. Plunkett at this time was represented by several other lawyers. Mr. Shoemaker was not the only lawyer that Mr. Plunkett was accustomed to. There's a list in the record of other lawyers that Mr. Plunkett was familiar with and had been represented around the time of this incident.
Does this court have to agree with you that that's unclear or ambiguous in order to find that it was inappropriate to sanction your client? If this court finds it clear?
If the court finds that it's clear that the client has to waive a consent in writing, mm-hmm. I don't believe that there is a document in the record that Mr. Plunkett signed that said, I'm aware of this potential conflict and I'm going to waive that conflict.
Does your client see nothing wrong with 2 hours before the foreclosure bringing these people in with him not even there?
I'm sorry. We're talking about two different people now. Because now we're talking about the Skintas.
Yes.
Okay. And in response to the Skintas, can I get a drink of water?
Please.
Uh-huh. The rule and the clarity of the rule applies to both of them. It applies to both. The hearing panel found the same violation for both clients, correct?
No, that's not the case, because I'll tell you what they found with regard to Mr. Skinton. And I'll read to you. Respondent is guilty of professional misconduct as to Mrs. Dorothy Skinton. They don't say Andy Skinton, the husband. They say Dorothy Skinta, the wife. Mrs. Dorothy Skinta was not given a reasonable opportunity to seek the advice of legal counsel. Respondent did not obtain Mrs. Dorothy Skinta's consent in writing signed by Mrs. Dorothy Skinta. But Mr. Shoemaker never talked to Dorothy Skinta, never. He talked to Andy Skinta.
He said he wouldn't stop the foreclosure unless they both signed, right?
Excuse me. Mrs. He didn't say to them, I'm going to stop the foreclosure if you both sign. And I think that's a little bit a problem with the case against Mr. Shoemaker. I mean, the hearing panel found that there was a benefit to the Skintas. I mean, they first came to Mr. Shoemaker 3 days before the foreclosure, after they had already solicited him to buy the property, to go to the foreclosure sale and make a bid at the property.
Wasn't part of the issue that the same thing happened with both Mr. Plunkett and with the Skintas, that they came to his office, they were presented with documents, they both asked to speak to Mr. Shoemaker before being required to sign them and were unable to do that, or was that just relevant to the Skintas?
I think there was some divergence, some disagreement about Mr. Plunkett, okay, whether he came to the office.
And that has to do with all the timing issues and having it mailed to him and things.
I'm sorry. Quite frankly, if you believe Mr. Plunkett, which the hearing panel said they essentially did not find him credible, then that version may be true. But with quite frankly, if you believe the other version of the fact, he had 9 days after this document was presented to him, and he did present this document to Mr. Shoemaker at a lunch meeting. And so the part of the problem is, if you believe her version of the facts, then you might be able to come to that conclusion. But it's just like the fact we're talking about now. It's not a Mr. Plunkett's version of the facts. It's just simply not credible. He says that he wanted a $2,000 loan, which he said he wanted to go to Texas, to take a trip to Texas. And he says, in the information, that's another problem. There's some contention, why didn't Mr. Shoemaker just consent to this? Because many of the facts in the information are not true. And the hearing panel found that they're not true. And if you look at it, in the information it says that Mr. Shoemaker put Mr. Plunkett in a squeeze, and then Mr. Plunkett came to him for a loan.
Can I interrupt you?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Does Mr. Shoemaker admit any violation of the rules at all?
Well, let me. If what you're asking me, does Mr. Shoemaker believe that his course of conduct is going to be drastically different? The answer.
No, that's not my question. My question is, does he admit any violation of the rules?
I think that he says that he would have done it differently today.
Okay, so he does not admit any violation of the rules.
Well, I don't think that he says he technically violated the rules. I don't think he says he did not substantially violate the concepts of the rules.
I'm trying to understand whether he says, whether he admits that he there were violations of the rule, that they don't warrant the severe punishment of having his license suspended, or if he
let me try to answer that this way, okay? Mrs. Whedon said in the argument, and I'm trying to answer that question. I think I understand the thrust of it. Mrs. Whedon says, you are not supposed to talk about settlement. This is in her closing argument. You are not supposed to talk about settlement negotiations in the case, but I tell the panel this. Early on in this matter, before Skinta complaint came in, before a great deal of investigation had been done, I think I wrote Mrs. Walker and said, if Mr. Shoemaker will admit to certain basic factual averments that I have made in a pleading that I sent along, we would stipulate to public reprimand, and there it was no. Okay, here's my answer.
Your focus is, because that doesn't seem to answer my question.
Well,
your focus
I'm sorry.
Is on what she said, and I'm asking what your client's position is in this proceeding.
My client, quite frankly, my client would have considered some resolution, because he's always tried to do that, some resolution. But here we are today, much later, in which he's confronted with two unbelievable witnesses confronting his integrity. And essentially saying that what he did was totally wrong, and they are totally unbelievable. And the situation's different now. Now, if what you're suggesting, would my client have tried to resolve this matter beforehand? The answer is yes, he would have. But quite frankly, the demands were that he essentially admit averments that we know now are not true. And there's no disputing some of them. Much of what's in the information we know now is not right.
Okay. Any further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Addressing the complicated rule argument, I would merely respond, then why didn't Mr. Shoemaker raise that at any point in this proceeding until today? He did not say in his response, oh my gosh, I never even connected the fact that I was representing Rusty in a PI case with what was going on with MACB. Now I've read the rule. Now I see where it could apply. Let's work this out. Never happened. It was adamantly, I did nothing wrong. These people are liars. These people are social outcasts. and on and on and on. That the complicated rule argument does not fly. As far as credibility of the witnesses, yes, the DHP did conclude that the complaining witnesses were largely not credible. They didn't cite to specific instances in the record wherein they found a lack of credibility in the testimony other than the pay issue, which has been gone over ad nauseum in the pleadings, so I won't go over that again. But I would think that the real inquiry for this court is what is Mr. Shoemaker's credibility? And I have cited to specific instances in the record that show a lack of credibility on Mr. Shoemaker's part. First, he and his secretary both testified that Shoemaker only went out and borrowed money to put into MACB in September of 06 after he had gotten Mr. Plunkett to sign the promissory note and the deed of trust.
Does the decision by the hearing panel find Mr. Shoemaker not credible?
I don't think
in certain respects.
I don't think it found either way on the credibility of Mr. Shoemaker. I don't recall that it does. When, in point of fact, Mr. Shoemaker's own exhibit bank record showed that money started going into MACB even before, according to his version of events, Mr. Plunkett signed the paperwork. So that was not true. The outside witnesses that, excluding Mr. Shoemaker, his two secretaries, and his friends, I cite the court to the testimony of Chris Shoemaker, who was another participant in MACB, a member of the LLC. Mr. Shoemaker claims that the deed of trust was handed to him by Mr. Plunkett at a restaurant in Lenexa, Kansas, on September 14, 2006. Mr. Shoemaker testified at the hearing and was asked, did you see this deed transaction go forward? No. Do you recall any discussion about it? No. Well, that's from an objective witness saying that, and he was the chief financial officer of MACB. Why in the world, if it happened the way that Mr. Shoemaker testified that it happened, would that not have come up during conversation during the lunch on September 14? But it didn't. Mr. Shoemaker,
SHOE. Are there any further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.